open my... Thank you all for coming. This is a really special seminar through the Computational Biology, Ecology, and Evolution Group, or COMBE for short. We're happy to host Professor Tammy Steeves from the University of Canterbury. Dr. Tammy Steeves' research interests focus on the ecological and evolutionary processes that contribute to the formation and maintenance of species boundaries, and the application of this knowledge to enhance the recovery of species at risk. She co-leads the Conservation, Systematics, and Evolution Research Team, or CONSERT, at the University of Canterbury. In partnership with relevant indigenous peoples of New Zealand, tribes and conservation practitioners in local communities, CONSERT combines genomic and non-genomic data to co-develop conservation genetic management strategies for some of New Zealand's rarest treasured species. Dr. Steeves is also a co-founder of the Kindness in Science Collective, a diverse collective based in New Zealand leading a culture shift in the science community that embeds kindness to achieve better science outcomes. So we'd all like to give a warm welcome to Dr. Steeves. Take it away.
Kia ora, tēnā koutou, katoa, e te tangata whanawa, Ho-Chunk Nation, ke te mihi. So, kia ora, or hello everyone, and I also acknowledge the people of this place, the Ho-Chunk Nation. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about me, starting with where I'm from. So I grew up camping at the base of the Three Sisters Mountains in the Rocky Mountain Range and canoeing on the Bow River with my dad. And I'm a Canadian who's been privileged to live and work in Aotearoa, New Zealand, for the last 15, 16 years, and working on some of the country's rarest tauna, or treasured species. And given the title of today's talk, I stand in front of you feeling very whakamā. And whakamā is a te reo Māori word, and so te reo is language, and Māori are the indigenous peoples of New Zealand. And it's very challenging to translate indigenous languages into English. It's fairly insufficient. But in this context, whakamā means that I'm a bit shy and a bit humble to present on behalf of an incredible team of Māori and non-Māori researchers. So I'd just like to introduce you to a few of them, starting with Levi Collier-Robinson. So Levi did his master's with me, and he's now a PhD student in our research team. And he led this particular manuscript, which literally just became published last Monday. It's been on EcoEvo archive for a wee while, but it's now available through the New Zealand Journal of Ecology. And Levi led this team as part of his master's, and then he's continuing the additional work that I'll be talking about today comprises that master's as well as some of his PhD research. And I'd also like to introduce you to Aisling Rain. And so Aisling is another PhD student in our research team, and she's also leading a project that's currently in revision with another team, or some of the same players in the previous slide, but also some additional Māori and non-Māori practitioners and scientists. And so because all of the work that we do within my research team is done within local context, I'd like to put New Zealand into context for you now. So if you've not been, do come. But if you're not entirely sure where New Zealand is, we're basically tucked down into the South Pacific, and it's comprised of two main islands, the North Island and the South Island, or Te Waipounamu. So the context here for us, and as myself as a conservation geneticist, is that New Zealand has the dubious distinction of being the country with the highest proportion of threatened species in the world. So we've got almost 4,000 species that are threatened or at risk of extinction. And most of the reasons for that is the isolation of New Zealand meant that the vast majority of the plants and animals that actually are endemic to New Zealand, of which there are many, because it's an island country, evolved in the absence of terrestrial mammalian predators. So the only terrestrial mammals that we have in New Zealand that are endemic are bats. So the arrival of humans, starting with Polynesians around 850 years ago, brought in three waves of invasive mammalian predators and literally have eaten their way through the indigenous fauna and flora of New Zealand. So the additional context that's quite important for our research is that we do partner with indigenous communities. So again, in a New Zealand context, this is Māori. And what I'm showing here is Te Waipounamu, which is the South Island. And I show you this because I'm gonna see if that works. We're based here. Christchurch is where we reside. And all of these little dots represent sub-tribes of a large tribe called Ngāi-Tahu on the South Island. And so Ngāi-Tahu pretty much encompasses pretty much everything from here down. And because we, the university, reside on the land or the whenua of these guys, Ngāi-Tuatahi, they are the sub-tribe that we most often initiate partnerships with. But as you'll see, we also extend our partnerships as and where it's relevant. So to put this into further context in terms of why we have a very clear mandate in New Zealand to partner with our indigenous communities is because New Zealand was actually founded based on a single treaty document, which is quite dissimilar to the States here and also to Canada where I'm from. So I just want to show you a brief video that gives you an overview of that history.
At the beginning of the 19th century, over 100,000 Māori populated Aotearoa and small groups of Europeans lived as guests of local iwi. But by 1830, over 1,000 ships were visiting New Zealand each year. Lawlessness had become a big problem and property speculators pressured Māori into bad land deals. In addition, concerns the French wanted to annex New Zealand prompted 13 Māori northern chiefs to petition King William IV for protection. Trade continued to flourish, and by 1835, Māori had an economic need for nationhood and the Declaration of Independence was signed. Proud Britain saw an opportunity to bring New Zealand into its empire, and the Crown sent William Hobson to negotiate sovereignty over part or all of New Zealand. Within a week of arriving, Hobson hurriedly penned an agreement, and on February 6, 1840, the Treaty of Waitangi was signed. But there were complications with the translation. In the Māori version, the word sovereignty was translated as kāwanatanga. Chiefs believed they retained the right to manage their own affairs. The English version guaranteed undisturbed possession of all properties. The Māori version translated this as tino rangatiratanga, or full authority over their treasures or taonga, which can be intangible. Essentially, both the Crown and Māori believed they held sovereignty. This has been at the heart of the conflict since 1840.
There we go. You can look at stuff for a little while. Let me just slip to the next slide. There we go. So to provide context, I think the video does talk about the heart of the conflict. And essentially what that means is that before even the first pen dried on the treaty was breached by the Crown. And it's continues to be breached to this day. But starting in about 1975, New Zealand and the Crown, the government at the time, thought about how we can best reconcile these grievances. And something called the Treaty of the Waitangi Tribunal was set up. And what's happened since 1975 is a number of tribes and sub-tribes have negotiated with the Crown to reach settlement. And so Ngāi-Tahu, which is the tribe I mentioned earlier, settled about 20 years ago, a little over 20 years ago. Whereas some of the other tribes or sub-tribes that we work with have yet to settle or literally just settled this year. So when we're partnering with our indigenous communities, we need to be mindful of their local context and what their relationship is and where they sit in the settlement space. But what I'd like to do now is that we did briefly say at the beginning, thanks for the introduction, that we work with genomic data and non-genomic data. So in the context of working with genomic data, we need to think about which aspects of the treaty are the most relevant to our research experience. And so I'm just going to briefly highlight two turns of phrase in Article 2 of the treaty. And that the first is tino rangatiratanga, and the rangatiratanga showed up in that video. And again, it's very challenging to translate into English, but we're essentially talking about self-determination, independence, autonomy. And so the idea here is that Māori have the authority to to practice and share their culture in their own way. It's not dictated by the crown. So that's the first context. The second is the phrase tauna katoa. So tauna are treasured things, and katoa is everything. So tauna can be tangible, like our birds or like our trees, but it can also be intangible. And the intangible here, again, with the most relevant context of where we work, we start out with te reo Māori. So again, that's the Māori language, which is closely linked to Mātauranga Māori, which is Māori knowledge, because we know that indigenous languages hold knowledge, and they hold practice. So the tikanga, which is the next intangible tauna, which is essentially cultural practices. And we have to remember here too that Māori actually weren't Māori until the British arrived. So we're not dealing with one big homogenous group of indigenous peoples, but rather a whole series of tribes and sub-tribes that are now being collapsed into something called Māori. So we need to realize that their tikanga or their protocols or practices may differ according to place and space. And then also the last word I have there is whakapapa. So whakapapa is often drilled down to genealogy. Think about pedigrees or family trees. But I've got a wee asterisk there as well, because it's much more than genealogy. So whakapapa is a central concept in the Māori worldview. And what it does is it layers the historical, the contemporary, the, look at my own words here, spiritual and mythological context of Te Ao Māori, which is the Māori world. And because of that, it's critical to how Māori see the world. Fundamentally, everything is connected. And it's not just the living things. This goes all the way up through the rivers and the mountains and all the way up to the Atua or to the gods. So it's not surprisingly, if we're thinking about an evolutionary context, this is easily translatable. This makes a lot of sense. But where it also makes an awful lot of sense is in the context when we're dealing or handling the genomic data, so the DNA data, that we actually extract from tauna species, so from treasured species. And the extension of whakapapa is that DNA itself is a physical form of that. So when we extract DNA from a treasured species, we're holding their whakapapa in our hands. And because that whakapapa is so incredibly central to the Māori worldview, it's tapu or it's sacred. So there are tikanga or protocols that actually need to be applied to it. But not surprisingly, when we're dealing with, say, emerging genomic technologies, there may not be readily available tikanga that actually exists. We don't actually have those protocols already. So again, what the treaty does, it gives us the mandate to then partner with our Māori communities and co-develop or learn from those protocols and apply them. So fundamentally, what we're looking to do is not think of Mātauranga Māori or indigenous knowledge as this thing in the past, but it's the past and the present and the future. And so what I'd like to do now is essentially walk you through what that might look like. And I call it a story with three chapters. And so we'll start with the first chapter of partnership. And again, what we're looking to do is to embed the treaty in everything that we do. And the way that we first framed this is using something, this iterative decision-making framework that Levi actually developed or co-developed with our partners at the beginning of a particular project where we're partnering with our local sub-tribe. So this is Ngāi Ahuri, and we were thinking about what questions we might actually ask. And then from there, we worked in partnership. And I'm just going to walk you through this a little bit to explain what I mean. And there'll be no test on pronouncing some of these principles. So where we sit here is, so before we do any research on a tauna or treasured species, we want to know what our questions are. We want to be asking questions that matter. We don't want to be, I think I committed the typical kind of sin that you do when you're come from away and you come from a new country. You're like, okay, there's this treaty, there's this thing. I'm going to knock on the door and say, hey, I'm doing this project on this tauna species. It's so cool. Are you interested? Only to get crickets. because actually they're interested in other things, not the thing that I'm necessarily interested in. Whereas what this is more of a, hey, I've actually got these skills. Are they of use to you? So this is where we start in the framing. And let's say we come up with a question, and I will give you an example of a question. Then we think about, all right, we're going to generate some genomic data. So where are we going to sample individuals? How are we going to sample them? When are we going to sample them? And then we'll move into, okay, we've got the samples. Now we want to generate some genomic data. Where are we going to do that? Are we going to do that in New Zealand? Are we going to do that overseas? Where are we going to store those data? How are we going to enable access of those data? And fundamentally, then, how are we going to share the results of our co-developed research? And what we've got here in this is that this is really an iterative decision-making framework, because we actually, it's not a simple 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 step. Rather, we reiterate in all of these scenarios. So no one decision predicates the next decision. It's always renegotiated at every step. And these four principles that we've got here are incredibly important, and I'll just go through them briefly. So we've seen rangatiratanga, so which is essentially giving Māori the authority to practice and share their culture in their own way. What we're doing is giving them decision-making authority in this scenario, which is why this blue is nice and fat. Then we've got whanaungatanga. And that word, the first part of it is whānau, which is family. And what you're doing there is you're building and maintaining relationships. And of course, we see that color the whole way through. But not surprisingly, it's really thick when we're first framing our research questions and when we're sharing the results of our research. It's incredibly important we get that right. And then we've got another principle called kaitiakitanga. And it's really guardianship of all tauna. So we might work with a species that is a tauna or a treasured species, but it's not just the species, it's the habitat within it lives. If it's a species that's harvested for food, then it's how that food is harvested, the language associated with that, the knowledge associated with that. It's all of these things within kaitiakitanga. So you can imagine, again, important the whole way through, but especially important when we're thinking about sampling treasured species, when we're thinking about generating data from them, and then where we're going to store and ultimately share that data. And then our last one is tohunatanga. And tohunga were elders in the past that held a lot of the knowledge within a particular sub-tribe or tribe. So tohunatanga is basically building capability and capacity in the entire team. So for example, me building in capacity so I can stand up and talk about this, but similarly with our partners building capability and capacity to understand what it is that we're doing and why we want to do it, and to have the autonomy and the authority to make informed decisions. And in the case of Levi actually whakapapas to this sub-tribe, so he is both a researcher and the person holding some authority at the same time. So what this led us to, this process led us to, is a project that I've had the privilege of leading for the past couple of years. It is still extending a little bit forward, and it's part of something called the National Science Challenges in New Zealand. These were set up to tackle some of New Zealand's biggest problems. And we fall within the biological heritage or bioheritage channel challenge. So we're thinking about biodiversity and as well as biosecurity. And what we did in partnership with Ngāi Tū Ahuri, our sub-tribe that we partner with, is come up with two research aims and identified two focal species that were of the most interest to them. And so we've got, this is KKY, or freshwater crayfish, and Kawato, or Canterbury mudfish. And we'll get to know them more in a moment. But we also partnered with others to look at other tauna species. This is a wetapanga, or giant weta, hihi, or stitch bird, and kaka, or brown parrot. And what we're looking to do here is to be responsive to what New Zealand's been really good at, which is we've got a lot of threatened species that are losing habitat, and both in quantity and quality, but are also being eaten into oblivion. So we've been really, really good at putting the individuals of these species into safe places, whether it's a predator-free offshore island or behind a predator-proof fence or in a predator-reduced area. But what that means is we've done a really good job of creating small, isolated populations. And when populations are small and isolated, they lose genetic diversity through genetic drift. And that's a worry if you're a conservation geneticist. So this particular project was really aimed at how can we do this better and what do we do now that we've got all of these small isolated populations? Should we mix them? Should we not mix them? Where should we put them? When should we put them there? That's fundamentally what we're trying to do in this project. And one of the reasons why it was so incredibly important and telling, I think, is in terms of why these were research questions of interest to our local subtribe, is that there's a real disconnect between threat status and legal protection in New Zealand, whether you're a terrestrial species or you're a freshwater species. So one of our freshwater ecologists that we collaborate with is fond of saying, out of sight, out of mind. So these species that sit underneath the water, we don't see them, we don't worry about them quite as much. And so I've just used our parrot here to represent our terrestrial vertebrates. These are our terrestrial invertebrates with our wetapanga. Our kawaro, our fish, is here for our freshwater vertebrates. And our KKY is our freshwater invertebrates. And so even though we have similar proportions of species that are threatened or at risk or not threatened or we don't know a lot about, we have very different legal protection for them. So much so that the only freshwater native fish that's protected in New Zealand is the grayling, and it went extinct in 1932. So that protection is not very helpful. And what that also then means is, again, we've done a really good job about moving individuals and populations around, so translocating them. But because we've got extensive legal protection for these species, lots of people interested in them, it means we've got lots of scientific evidence, we've got lots of protocols that are available for these particular threatened species. And we have very, very little for these ones. So what we've got is a number of species, many, many species, that we really don't know what to do with because we don't have that evidence base. Right. So let's introduce you to kawaro, or Canterbury mudfish. And so they are likely New Zealand's most threatened freshwater fish. And they're confined mostly to the Canterbury region, but we'll see it expands a bit farther than Ngāi Tuatahi's range, so the local sub-tribe. They're an awesome fish that can breathe through their skin. They can survive brief periods of drought by kind of tunneling into the mud. And they're a little bit problematic because they don't like to coexist with things like freshwater eel. They are considered tauna by Ngāi Tahu, the bigger tribe, and also the local sub-tribe, but we're not sure why. We do know that similar fish up in the North Island were used as fertilizer in the past. We do know they don't coexist with freshwater eel, which are incredibly prized food source. So it's possible they were used as an indicator species to say, oh, there's lots of kawaro, there's no tuna here, we'll move somewhere else. And what's actually happening is Levi is about to go through some of the very old and incredibly precious records that Ngāi Tahu holds to actually try and sort out what the role of kawaro was in the past. But in the meantime, we know that kawaro is important to our local subtribe because it is an important component of a place called Tuhaitara Coastal Park where they're looking to rejuvenate that particular ecosystem, or to not really to store, but definitely rehabilitate that ecosystem. And what that enables us to do is actually really cool things like this. So this is Levi actually sampling kawaro with local kids from the local Māori school. Just so happens it's the exact same school he went to when he was young, and actually build that tohunatanga within these kids as they sample kawaro, and these are called little biota nodes in the coastal park. And then, so that's kawaro. We've got KKY, or freshwater crayfish, and so their threat status is at risk declining. But like a lot of threat statuses, both in New Zealand and around the world, including here in the States, these global or national level statuses can hide all sorts of ills. So for example, this is, again, there's where Christchurch is, and this region right here is that, the land of our local sub-tribe. We're dealing with a huge number of local extirpations. So we've got small populations or once large populations that are being blanked out because of farming, or in most instances it's actually suburbs that go up because they're incredibly sensitive species. Whereas if we go farther down in their range, there are pockets where KKY are actually doing relatively well. Nowhere where they're doing absolutely brilliantly because humans are around, but we're definitely really worried about our local populations, as is our local subtribe, because these are freshwater crayfish. They're a traditional food source, and all of the knowledge associated with them is being lost as the species are lost. So what our project did is actually work with the local kaitiaki, so that is the guardian, and that's Makarini right here, and a local expert, which is Chanel Toms, who did her master's on KKY, but is currently working on a species called kakahi, which is a freshwater mussel. And the way that the sampling was conducted is using actually a traditional method of harvesting called tokura, which is a bracken fern bundle. And actually, Chanel showed during her master's that if you wanted to monitor KKY, these methods were actually the most appropriate methods. And so that's, again, where we can use past knowledge to inform future practices. And then also, the knowledge that Maka also used is something called the Maramataka, which is the Maori lunar calendar. So he was the one who decided where the tokura went, and he was the one who decided when the tokura was brought up. So what we were doing there when we were doing this sampling was that we wanted to generate genomic resources for these species. So we could then hopefully do something like characterize adaptive variation, which just means the variation in the genome that actually does something and might enable the species to adapt to future change down the track. But when we think about what we know about the genomes of a species like Kawaro or a genome like a species like KKY, it's tumbleweeds, right? We knew nothing. And so what we first do with our partners is talk about, well, what do we know about other species that are more or less closely related? And if we're talking about, you know, an arthropod and a fish, we know there's a lot of diversity in there. And not surprisingly, there's a heck of a lot of diversity in the size of genomes. So we have a tiny little fish genome, less than a billion base pairs, and our lungfish at 133 billion base pairs. So we had to think about how are we going to generate a little bit of data to estimate genome size in these species, and where are we going to do it, and how are we going to do it? And this leads us a little bit farther down into our decision-making framework, where we're having a conversation with our local subtribe about where to generate the data in the first place, knowing that we don't actually know how big the genomes are. So we have to think through the various ways that we might actually want to generate those genomic data. And related to that is actually where we will do the generation in itself. And New Zealand, small island country, we're pretty excited because we've got almost 5 million people total. There are about four times as many more sheep in New Zealand as there are people. Okay, so not exactly the best place on the planet to develop innovative emerging genomic technologies. We know as soon as we order them, actually before we order them, they're outdated. So in my very biased view, I'm of the opinion that we should let the big boys work with their toys, get all of the technologies and where they're well resourced in large facilities with high throughput. And what we can do is build that tohunatanga within New Zealand, which is building the capability and capacity of actually working with those data and using those data to inform outcomes. So to that end, the way that we work when we're working with our local subtribe here and also other subtribes that we work with other species in the group, is we provide two options. Because I've been challenged in the past, I've showed this decision-making framework in other contexts and have had people come up to me quietly afterwards and go, yeah, but like, who really makes the decisions? It's not them, right? It's you. And I'm like, no, it's for real. It's not me at all. It is them. And so this is an example of the way that we'll actually have a conversation like that. And so what we've got is a scenario where we can actually generate data in a facility in Germany. This is one where the head bioinformatician is a good friend and colleague. I have an infinite trust in him. And also, it's a human clinical facility that regularly works with high throughput human data. I can't think of a safer place than a human clinical facility in Germany in terms of its data security agreements. And we also have facilities in New Zealand that we can use that are okay, but they're not awesome. And so, but they will, if we generate data with them, it will be safe, so the security arrangements are good or high. We'll get, you know, a reasonable amount of data and of reasonable quality, and it's going to take us for ages, so we'll have to be patient, and it's going to cost us more. But if we don't want DNA to leave the shores of New Zealand, that's okay. In all genuineness, if this is not what we want to do, we can answer the questions that we have staying in New Zealand. But what happens in relationships like this, or what's been happening for us in our experience, is that understanding the questions that we're asking and why we're asking them about where we might actually generate data, it almost becomes a little bit of a no-brainer. Well, of course I want to go with the first option, because if we're sure that we're safe, we're sure that we can review the data security agreement, we can adjust it how we see fit so that we feel safe, then let's go with the first option. And so far, that's what we've done. But again, this is the conversation we had to generate the genome. We had the exact same conversation again when we were talking about resequencing or generating more whole genome data. And I'll touch on that in a second. But the good news is we got very lucky. With Kawato, we budgeted for about a 4 gigabase genome, so a little bit bigger than the human genome. And it ended up being less than a billion base pairs, about 700 megs. So we're like, woohoo, that's great. And it's also really, really great because the genome is relatively small, it then answered our next question for us, which was, hey, if the genome's so small, we want to generate whole genome resequencing data for our population genomic analyses, as opposed to using reduced representation. And that matters because that means we're going to suggest we should go back to Germany. But are we sure? How do we feel about that? In contrast, KKY was a little bit bigger, but not as big as we feared. We budgeted around 8 gigabases, about 8 billion base pairs, and we got a little under 3. But this size is enough to say, ooh, actually, we can't really afford to generate whole genome data for individuals with a genome this size, so we're going to use a reduced representation approach, and we'll do that within New Zealand. So we don't need to revisit that conversation because those data are being generated in New Zealand. So further to that, of course, I showed where the distributions were for these species. We have to think about where we're actually going to be doing the sampling for the population level data. And just as a reminder, this region here effectively is our local subtribe, and we come down into regions of other subtribes for the remainder of Kawato's distribution. For KKY, we're about in here. We've got subtribes that are up a little bit more north and many others that are down farther in their distribution. So currently where Levi and Ashling are now is building those relevant relationships with other local subtribes to do the sampling and the tissue and the data generation across the whole range. Now, something that we like to do within our group is be as non-invasive as we possibly can be, and also to make sure that we get the data that we need to answer the question at hand. And so this is just an example of a paper that we published a few years back when we were working with genetic data, so just a handful of markers. And we asked the question, how many samples do you need to generate representative allele frequencies? And the answer here for genetic markers, a handful of genetic markers, was about 25 to 30 individuals. Now, we didn't think it was going to be 25 to 30 individuals, for example, for whole genome resequencing data. We thought we could probably get away with less, but how much less? So what we did is we have an available data set for a critically endangered bird. This is not a fish or a freshwater crayfish. This is a khaki or black stilt, and my postdoc here, Stephanie, actually generated these data. And we know that birds and fish are different, like don't worry, we know that. But the species themselves actually both have relatively small genomes. They're not that complex, And like kawaro being critically endangered, so are kaki. So we used our kaki resequencing data as a proxy for kawaro to say how many individuals do we need to sample across the species range in our putative populations. And so the short answer here is that unlike genetic data where we just worry about allele frequencies, when we're working with whole genome resequencing data, we need to worry about sample size, but also coverage. So how many times we see a particular variant represented in our sequence data. Because we feel a lot more confident when we see that variant many more times. We can actually call a heterozygote a lot more readily. And so, but the long story is this is just a summary of a whole lot of subsampling that Levi did as part of his master's. Whereas if we've got relatively low coverage data, so this was 6 times data within the Kaki data set, which basically means that we, on average, we saw that variant 6 times, which means we'd feel pretty comfy if we saw an A 3 times and a T 3 times. We're like, oh, that's an actual variant. It's an AT variant. But what if we get 4 A's and 2 T's? It's like, how comfortable do we feel about that being a variant? And then when we've got this moderate coverage is 10 times coverage, which we generally use for birds in our group, because in part, if we go all the way up to 17 times coverage, there's not much difference. And what we see here is if we actually think about where these asymptote, it's at about 8 samples. So many fewer than 25. And because we know that we sometimes lose samples along the way, what Levi's been doing is generating data for about 10 individuals per site for kawaro. And because the KKY genome is a little bit bigger and we're not certain about the kind of coverage we'll get, we've gone to about 12 individuals per site for KKY. And so where this data sits now is that Levi is literally swimming in a whole lot of, well, not literally, figuratively swimming, in a whole lot of resequencing data for kawaro. So that ends the chapter of this particular story. And I'd like to move on to the next chapter, which continues with KKY. And so now what we're talking about is partnership with primary industry, but also with indigenous communities, but the primary contact is with primary industry. And so for us in New Zealand, primary industry is things like forestry, agriculture, dairy, crops, that kind of thing. And this is a manuscript that Stephanie Gallo, who is again here with me today, led a few years ago in molecular ecology, where we realized that there's a really lovely synergy between primary industry researchers and conservation genetic researchers, in that primary industry has been using genomic data for much longer than we have, but they know a little bit less maybe about the theory behind small population size. So by pairing together, we could lead to mutually beneficial outcomes to say, okay, you know something about genomics, I know something about small population sizes, what can we actually do together? And so one example of that is this next chapter. So we're still with KKY, the freshwater crayfish, and this time we're talking about a partnership that started before we got on the scene, and that was through Earnslaw One, which is a forestry company, and Ngāi Tahu, the big tribe that is on the majority of the South Island. And what they did was that what we're looking at here is one forestry block that Earnslaw One had. When they first started, not all these little tiny ponds were there. There was a few ponds. Because of those of you who've been on a forestry block, there's always ponds in case there's a fire. They're there for fire risk. But someone had a really good idea about, hey, could we farm freshwater crayfish? And they hired a guy named John Hollows, who knows something about KKY. And he basically led the development of a husbandry manual for farming KKY, or freshwater crayfish. And the idea with this was not only to make Earnslaw One money, which is now in a subsidiary called Kiwi, so this is the company name here, and this is set up for commercial export with the predominant target being the Asian market. It was also to return this food to sub-tries across Ngāi Tahu's range on the South Island. So these kids here are at a place called Hokanui, which is another sub-tribe on the South Island. And this is when they were first translocating KKY to aquaculture ponds in their own backyards, effectively. And so the idea here is that this was set up to enhance customary harvest, but also commercial harvest. When we first met John, we realized that actually a lot of his ponds were stocked using not very many individuals, and he was worried about productivity. And we said, okay, we know something about that. We think there might be a reason why your productivity and the size of your animals is decreasing over time. Can we partner to try and figure out a better way to manage all of these individual ponds? So across all of Kiwi's, all of Earns Law 1's forestry blocks, John has about 4,000 ponds, about half of which are stocked. And the half of which are stocked leads for really cool opportunities for really fun partnerships. And that's because something that's become really interesting to conservation geneticists like myself and those of us in the team is this thing called genetic rescue. And what genetic rescue is taking a population that's gone through a bottleneck and lost lots of diversity, and as its fitness is decreased, so productivity is low in a commercial context, and taking individuals from somewhere else that have new or lost diversity and introducing it back into those populations that are lacking diversity. And as conservation geneticists, what we're really interested in is, well, if we actually see an increase in productivity or fitness following a genetic rescue event, why? And we want to know why, because it impacts what we actually do from a management context. So some think that we see genetic rescue or an increase in fitness or productivity in subsequent generations because the decrease in that is just due to basically inbreeding depression. So which we think what that is basically a whole bunch of once rare alleles that are maladaptive, and so they have a fitness cost associated with them. They're found in the homozygous state, and they reduce fitness or productivity. So if we actually bring in new diversity, we mask those deleterious recessive alleles. So from a management perspective, that means we just need to get new diversity. We don't care where it's from. We just want to mask these deleterious recessives. But another option, which is not mutually exclusive, is the integration of adaptive alleles. And if that's the case, we're actually introducing alleles that matter, that have some sort of adaptive or functional significance, then we need to be pretty mindful about where we're actually sourcing these individuals from, because we want to make sure we bring in the right alleles. So what we did in collaboration with John is set up, all bias included, what I think is a super fun genetic rescue experiment. Oh, sorry, let's go back one. So the scenario we've got here is this is Orete, which is a wild site, down in the South Island here, and Glenelg, which is over in a region which is really, really different. If you're on the ground, these are ecosystem-wise very, very different sites. And what John already had was a pond that had been sourced with individuals from here, and there was 59 founders. Still not huge, but for us, relatively big. And then he also had three other ponds that had been sourced from the same place, but were founded by very many fewer individuals. So these are the ones that we use as a proxy for our populations that might need genetic rescue. And then we've also got another source over here where individuals were sourced from Glenelg with a reasonably large number of individuals, 79 founders. And what we wanted to do was basically set up a series of genetic rescue experiments where we're trying to tease apart, is it the masking of deleterious recessive alleles? It doesn't matter where individuals come from. As long as they cover up those deleterious alleles, we're happy. Or do we need the integration of specific alleles? Might they be coming from here, or might they be coming from here? So what we've got is a series of new ponds where individuals are sourced from here and put into three new ponds, and individuals are sourced from each of our genetic rescue ponds and popped into here. And then similarly, we take individuals from here, put them in three ponds, replicate our rescue. We did a mixed one where we had source one and two, and then we have our control ponds, which are rescue only. Experimental design to end experimental designs. Many a whiteboard went into this, right? Thinking about what it would cost to actually monitor these sites over time. Do we have a replicated experiment? Oh my gosh, it's going to be so clever. And then Ashling did some preliminary data. to actually look at the individuals that were put into the ponds, so we knew who was there. And reality crept in. Because these are structure plots, so for those of you not familiar with them, what we're looking at is individuals down the bottom, so each bar represents an individual, and we've got two clusters here. One that corresponds to source one, so that's this pond here, which originally came from there, and the other is source two, which is this pond that originally came from there. Note, we didn't use the wild sites because we're dealing with a declining species and sourcing a bunch of individuals from a declining site is not very cool. So what we expected to see here in our three ponds, where these dark black bars represent our three ponds, is we expected this to be all purple and really kind of look like a rescue only because they were all sourced from the same place. And then we expected our source two to be half and half, so half orange, half purple, and our ones and twos to be a mix of that. So that's not exactly what we got, right? So Ashley generated these data and went, oh, this is really interesting. It looks like we have some individuals that might be like F1s, might be the product of a cross between individuals from here and here. That's not what we expected to see. And similarly in source two, we had a couple of individuals that didn't quite look like we expected them to look like. And so we called John and we said, John, these are the data. What do you reckon? And he's like, oh, talk about feeling fuckama. He went and talked to the fellow that he collaborates with, and it turns out that fellow, without letting John know, had actually moved some individuals into this source pond and moved some individuals into this source pond in an attempt to increase the diversity. And so we're like, oh, darn, oh dear. But the upside is now we've actually got a really cool experiment where we already have admixed individuals. And so just last week, Ashling was down doing a sampling. And if you've never seen a freshwater crayfish baby, there they are. They're adorable. And so these are little guys that have just hatched out. And they'll stay tethered to the female until they're much, much larger. And so that's Ashling there sampling. And also we've got some ponds that have these beautiful blue crayfish and golden crayfish too, because everybody likes to look at crayfish. So that's where we are with that project. And it's the relationship that we had with John, where John was like, oh no. But we felt comfortable going, John, like, what do we think about these data? You know, after we checked them 50 times, because that's what you do to make sure it wasn't us. And then John felt safe enough to say, oh no. And then we felt fine to go, that's okay. We don't have the perfectly replicated experiment that we wanted, but it's still cool. We can still do science. And so that sort of brings us to the end of that chapter, because we're still very much in the sampling stage in this book. And this one's short. I won't talk another 20 minutes, I promise. And this is one that sort of brings it all together. And I love this image because it's actually a satellite image. They captured the entire South Island, which is pretty cool, I think. And what we've got here is some more preliminary data that Ashling's generated from a number of sites, both from around our local tribes area and a couple of other areas as well. And again, what we're doing is we're looking at structure plots here, and where each bar represents an individual, and we've got, let's see, one, two, three, four different clusters. And so individuals that are kind of half and half look a little bit like, well, we've got an orange cluster, which actually we didn't capture, so they're probably from a wild site. But there's two sites that I just want to zone in on here. And the first is that these individuals were sampled from a place called Lake Janet. And Lake Janet is a human-made lake up in the foothills of Canterbury, where we live. And the individuals from here genetically look like individuals from way down south. And KKY don't fly, right? So they're little crayfish that don't tend to move very far. And we looked at those data and we said, John, what do you reckon? And he's like, oh, pig hunters. And lo and behold, like a week or two later, Ashling is actually in the bush doing some sampling up around Lake Janet, and she runs into pig hunters. Probably not the pig hunters, but pig hunters nonetheless, who start talking about when they excavated Lake Janet and when KKY were introduced and what a great place it is. And we're like, oh, okay, all right. So that's an interesting explanation potentially for why we see similarities from a lake from way up here as opposed to down south. But we need to be careful Because we also know that in a Māori context, there were a number of historical translocations that sub-tribes took while they were actually traveling across the South Island. So the name of the South Island, Te Waipounamu, Ponamu is greenstone or jade, and all along the west coast of the South Island, there's incredible Ponamu or jade deposits. And so there are a number of trails that brought Māori up and over the Southern Alps to actually source Ponamu. But there are also lots of trails that were just used for regular movement, not necessarily to source the Ponamu. And so we're like, okay, well, we could think pig hunters, but and it is human-made, so it does kind of make sense. But let's just be open to the possibility that there's another explanation for this pattern. And it makes us want to be fairly open to that because we have another scenario, which is a little bit curious, where we've got Lake Georgina having individuals that look very much like individuals down in the lowland plains. And again, this is not our story to tell. It's an early conversation that comes out of an initiative called Kahuru Manu. So this is a great atlas project. Actually, I did that in the wrong order. This is it here, Kahuru Manu. So this was a mapping project that Naitahu led. So you can Google this. It is breathtaking to see the stories and the knowledge that they've captured. And they did it in such a way that they wanted to capture and share it with the world in a way that it was still theirs. And so by that token, what we know is that if we go into the atlas, if we go into the atlas, all of these little green lines represent the Ka'ara Tupuna. Tupuna is ancestors and Ara is path. So these represent the paths that the ancestors took across the South Island. And our site is down here and up here. And we're quite sure that this little break probably isn't an actual break. It's probably a missing data break. And so we're currently partnering with sub-tribes across the South Island to further explore these data in a way where they can celebrate and collate and share their history, and we can augment that with genomic data. So we're in a place where it's not me as the person leading the project partnering with Indigenous communities, but Indigenous communities leading the research that I them partner with them to generate. And it's really, I mean, all gives me goosebumps. I think it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing stuff. So that's the end of that chapter. And where I want to end is on this particular slide, because if you remember in the iterative decision framework, we ended up in kind of towards, before we were sharing our narrative, we were thinking about data storage and data access. So for those of you that work in the genetic or genomic space, we know that we generally have an open science philosophy when it comes to genetic and genomic data. We put it in listservs like, not listservs, but in data repositories like GenBank. But do we do that, or should we do that, or how should we do that for species of cultural significance, whether that's human data or whether that's plant and animal data? And so there are numerous conversations that are going on across New Zealand about what we do with those data, and fundamentally we have some interim solutions. So there's an organization called Genomics Aotearoa, of which I'm a part of, that are developing an interim data repository where the end goal is to have basically a Gen Bank of New Zealand that's over whose oversight is a series of kahui or elders that aren't gatekeepers per se, but they're facilitators for those people who might be interested in accessing those data but not understanding the New Zealand context. And on a smaller scale, we've done that with our own research group, where all of the genomic data that we publish, that it's been sourced from Taonga or treasured species, is actually password protected. And we provide an explanation for why that is and an opportunity for engagement. And so it's not necessarily going to end up this way, but it is where we are now, which is thinking about how do we enable the sharing of data so it's still theirs. And it's a really exciting times and can be trying times. So for example, I've had a lot of people go, well, you can't do that. They won't let you. I'm like, who are they? Like, who are these they? These genomics police? I have no idea. I've never met them. And to date, we've published several papers that actually have data-protected data, and no one's batted an eyelash because we've explained the context. We're like, this is why we're doing what we're doing. And we're not saying the data squirreled away and you can never, ever get to it. We're just saying we want you to understand the local context before you work with it, so you understand that you're holding whakapapa in your hands. And that's me. So kia ora, thank you very much.
Thank you for that great talk. We'll take questions now. We usually have a reception afterwards for bacteriology talks. We're not doing that for this talk. Graham, are you taking Tammy to the set? So if you'd like to meet with Tammy afterwards over at the set at Union South, any questions for Dr. Steves?
Hi, that was really beautiful. Thank you so much for the work you're doing. What sequencing technologies are you using?
That's a good question. Depends on the project. And so to generate, just to estimate genome size for those two species, we just used short-read Illumina NovaSeq on a NovaSeq. But we're currently doing a reference genome for KKY using PacBio, and we'll likely bring in some Hi-C and do a hybrid genome assembly. We're debating whether or not we need to do that with Kawato. We generally run in the philosophy, is it a good enough genome that we need, or do we need a really flash genome and why? And we've got another project on Kaki, that black stilt that I mentioned. We're just about to do a PacBio Hi-C genome for them as well.
Hi, you presented a really beautiful framework for working with indigenous communities, and I was just wondering how you got to that point of like creating that and how it's impacted the work that you're doing.
Oh, it's a really awesome question, thank you. You just have to jump in at some point, but I think I can tell you my personal story. And so I've been in New Zealand for about 16 years. And I came back after my son was born, was my last kid, for sure, and went, that was 6 years ago, and said, you know, I work on these Taonga species, and I can do better than this. Like, this is such a huge privilege to do what I'm doing, and I need and want to do better. So what that meant is I just did a lot of reading and a lot of asking. It coincided, actually, with my own university really doing a lot of navel-gazing in this place and trying to think about how they could be a better treaty partner. So my desire to do this was facilitated by infrastructure within the university, which I appreciate. I was just visiting Canada before I was here. It's happening, I think, in Canada is the same it is here. There's lots of top-down, we should be doing this, we should be better partners, we should be mindful of our colonial history. But what I experienced in Canada was there wasn't a lot of infrastructure to support how to actually do that, whereas I really benefited and my team really benefited from structures. Like, we have a course called Tangata Tu, Tangata Ora, which is basically a treaty course for 2 days and sort of paints the local context and you understand what the treaty is. But you don't just do that for 2 days. And you sort of figure out where your local context is. For a lot of these tribes or sub-tribes, they might have resource management plans. You read them. So you understand what their priorities are. So when you don't rock up and say, hey, I'm doing this cool thing, isn't it awesome, come join me. You're like, oh, actually, I noticed that you're really interested in this particular species, and I think I might be able to be helpful for you. Would you like to talk about it? And so that's there. And then I think learning a little bit of the language. And I did a tiny little bit of what's called a pepeha at the beginning in Te Reo. The first time I did my full pepeha, oh my God, it was cringeworthy. It was so bad. But you have to start somewhere. And I was so lucky because I was in a room of people who were like, I can tell you're trying. You're really crash and burning here, but you're trying. You know, I'm rooting for you. And then you just get a little bit more confident as you go and you learn more and you make mistakes and you're like, oh, I probably could do that better next time. So I think you really just have to make a conscious decision to do better. Think about what resources you have around you to enable that, and then you just got to jump in. And as long as you're earnest and genuine and purposefully non-extractive, not entering with, hey, can you do this for me, or hey, I want to know this, or but you're much more genuine, you're treated with nothing but kindness, to be honest, yeah, which is pretty awesome.
Thank you.
It's a very long answer. I hope that was okay.
All right, let's thank Dr. Steves one more time.
Thank you.